Welcome to Plain Talk. Plain Talk has over 120 podcasts containing information about aviation technologies and pilot experiences for general and business aviation, from home to cockpit to boardroom to personal tech. Plain Talk provides information for pilots, industry insiders, and aviation enthusiasts alike. My name is Phil Lightstone. I'm a general aviation pilot with over 2,200 hours in my logbook, flying almost every week with over 30 years' experience in the technology, telecommunications, and aviation industries.
We're here at the Veterans Wing, the Sunnybrook Hospital in scenic downtown Toronto, Ontario, Canada, and like to welcome into the Plain Talk cockpit Captain Mortimer Lightstone, retired Royal Canadian Air Force, affectionately known as my Uncle Mort, my father's brother. Uncle Mort, welcome to the Plain Talk cockpit.
Oh, Phil, it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much for taking time out of your hectic day with all the other vets here at K-Wing and at Sunnybrook. And I really appreciate you having a little chit-chat about your history with the Royal Canadian Air Force.
Well, it's very nice to be with you, Phil. It's not so nice to be a permanent resident here in K-Wing because it's 100% commitment to be here for many, many years.
Well, I suppose, it's going to be the last taxi down that long runway to see your buddies at the great beyond.
Yep, a strange landing, that one.
No doubt. So, Uncle Mort, when did you decide and enter the Royal Canadian Air Force?
Well, I joined the Air Force in 1951, but I had some Air Force experience prior to that through the Air Cadets. I was an Air Cadet for 4 or 5 years, so that would be in the late 40s. At that time, the Air Cadet movement introduced flying scholarships. I was one of the first Air Cadets in Canada to receive a flying scholarship. So I took all that training. I have soloed. I had 5 hours in my Air Cadet pilot's logbook, which unfortunately, with the passage of time, I've lost and misplaced. But I did receive my Air Cadet wings, pilot's wings, when I was too old to be an Air Cadet, which I think was 16 or 17, I joined the Air Force Reserve, the RCAF Reserve. And I was there for, perhaps 6 months. When I graduated high school, I joined the Air Force and was trained as a navigator, and that was the start of my Air Force career.
Living in Ottawa, as a teenager, the Air Cadets must have brought to you a lot of structure, training, but of course, fully kitting you out with really warm clothes, especially during those Ottawa January brutal winters.
Yes, that was one of the great experiences when I joined the Air Cadets. It was 211 Ottawa Kiwanis Squadron, and we were sponsored by the Kiwanis Club of Ottawa, and the Kiwanis Club met regularly in the Chateau Laurier Hotel, and once or twice a year they would invite all the total squadron to the Chateau for lunch. That was always an exciting event. More significantly, getting kitted out included everything I need, from a good hat down to tunic, pants, socks, and boots.
And, of course, a big, long winter coat.
A winter coat. No, we didn't get a winter coat. We got raincoats.
Really?
The winter coat came when I joined the Air Force Reserves.
You finished high school and went into the reserves and then into the full-time forces?
Yeah, the first year of my service with the regular force, was a training year. I was trained as a navigator, a long-range navigator. It was very interesting because a couple of other things were happening at the same time. The war in Korea was underway, and the Air Force had decided to help train aircrew from NATO countries, and they picked the course that I was taking to be a NATO training course. Our complement was 50% Royal Air Force and 50% Canadians. There was a major difference between the Canadian participants and the RAF participants. The RAF were doing their national service. For any of the listeners that don't know what national service was in England, then every male had to serve for 2 years. This group of lads were drafted, had to do their 2 years. They were lucky in that when you have to serve 2 years, the first year of that, that's half your service, is going to be in Canada, and you were born and raised in England. It's just one big holiday.
So what was your first training base you were?
The first training base was at Summerside in Prince Edward Island, RCF Station, Summerside. It was the number 2 air navigation school was located there. Part of the experience of not only learning all the aspects of long-range navigation, but to get along with these RAF guys. For example, their shirts had detachable collars. So half the course, when came to do laundry, half the course had to wash their shirt collars separate from their shirts. And things like that were kind of amusing. But we got along well. We maintained the relationship over the next 50 years.
It must have been interesting in the base bar after work.
At Summerside, we had a cadet's mess. Canadians had the rank of flight cadet. The RAF lads had the rank of APO, an acting pilot officer. But we each wore the same rank badge, which was one thin ring around our sleeves. Plus, all aircrew trainees wear a white flash in their caps, their hats. The RAF lads had officers' caps, so they gave them a round plastic thing, a white plastic thing to go behind the cap badge. And the Canadians had a white slip of cloth that slipped into the rim of the wedge cap.
So 1 year of training, was all of it at Summerside?
All at Summerside. And when we went on our flying training, we flew in Dakotas, the DC-3s. Each flight was well planned, and we had certain objectives to meet, certain navigation things that we had to do in each of the flights, and progressively they got more complex and larger in numbers, so they were training us to pick up speed in the navigation. So I could talk about that for a moment. The speed of navigating when you're moving at, well, in the case of the Dakotas, we were flying at, as I recollect it, it's a long time ago, we were flying at a speed of about 125 knots. So what you have to do is first determine exactly where the aircraft is, and then with that knowledge you can calculate what the wind is. So we would carry an air plot where we would be if the air wasn't moving, but the air is moving because of the effect of the wind. So now we've got an air position and a ground position, an actual position, and that little bit of vector direction and the length of that vector tells us what the wind is. And then we calculate the correction to get to the destination if we're off track, and any change in the time of arrival, the ETA. But we have to do that and complete it within 6 minutes.
Wow. And for the Plane Talk audience, to remember. This is the 1950s. This is pre-GPS, pre-Loran, pre-VOR. So this is like essentially chart and ruler and pencil and E6B flight calculators. This is also about celestial navigation on your longer cross-country legs like Trenton to Seoul.
The aids that we would use were added progressively as we went through the course. So the first few flights were just looking out the window. Just look at the ground and find a ground feature that tells you where you are. Then progressively we had to learn to actually correctly measure the drift of the aircraft. And as all the listeners know, that's the difference between your heading and your actual track. And there was special instruments that looked like a reverse periscope. There must be a word for it when it goes down instead of up. But in any case, we'd look through it and we could see the drift. And then our field of view would be two things, the ground and a grid. And we just rotate the grid until the objects on the ground would slip parallel to that grid under the aircraft. And then we read the compass rose that's attached to the drift meter. And now we know our drift, 3 or 4 degrees port or starboard, whichever it was.
How long would you be in the air on a typical training sortie?
Well, in those flights, maybe 3 to 4 hours maybe. But there again, the length of the flights got longer as we progressed through the training. There is always that requirement of speed to get your position quickly. And once you have it, you've got to pass up the change of heading and the change of ETA to the pilot within 6 minutes.
So a lot of responsibility on the navigators to get the aircraft, the aircrew, from point A to point B safely and without running out of fuel.
Yeah, there was more to it than that, because once we thought we were okay doing that, they said, no, wait a minute, the job doesn't end there. When you go on a 7 or 8 or a 10-hour flight, critical part of your job is fuel conservation. In connection with the fuel conservation is the requirement to have a point of no return. So you have to calculate the point of no return for every leg. So if your mission requires a few legs, then there's a lot of work involved. And in addition to calculating point of no return, we'd have to calculate the critical point. In addition to that, there is all the emergency services, like plane is missing, or there's some other requirement to conduct an air search. An air search for something that you knew has crashed would be an increased distance pattern going in all four quadrants. So you fly 3 minutes east, then turn 3 minutes south, 3 minutes west, 3 minutes north, and you have to go a little further because you're expanding the search. And there's type of search is if you're not sure if the time the incident occurred, then you might have to do that pattern in conjunction with what's called a creeping line ahead. So you're expanding the search, but also moving further and further away from the last known position.
Your training being, a year long, you must have had to also deal with a lot of different weather, especially in the Maritimes, as your flights went from 1 hour to 3 hours to 4 hours.
Six,
and certainly at some times of the year, you've got in the Maritimes fog banks that'll come in and sock your primary destination, your alternate airport, the second alternate, freezing fog, freezing rain, brutal winter. What was it like flying in that weather environment?
We'd always attempt to fly on over a period of time when there wouldn't be any really bad weather during the training year. But occasionally you would run into some significant weather. But on every mission, we had pre-calculated the flying from the destination to an alternate aerodrome. And we'd have to include the calculations for aviation gas for an hour circulating over the destination airport. If we diverted, the same thing for the destination, enough gas to get to the alternative aerodrome. We needed enough gas to get to the aerodrome, an hour circulating, and so on. So there was a lot of calculations involved, and that was part of calculating the critical point and that sort of thing.
And part of building up your capabilities is experience before you go operational into harm's way. When you were on course for that year, were you ever in the quote-unquote clag?
Sorry, what was the...
Inside the scud, inside cloud, bad weather, freezing fog, airplane icing up, the things that lead airplanes to become accidents and incidents.
Yeah, we did, during the 1 year of training, we did run into some difficult weather. No particular incident comes to mind, but I do recall that we were shaken up a few times, and flying through turbulence and too close to CBs, cumulonimbus clouds. And that, of course, was another part of the training, was to understand the weather systems and cloud formations and so on. There was a lot involved, but serious change in weather conditions was part of my experience later on when I was doing more significant long-range flying, transoceanic in the Arctic and that sort of thing. It was always exciting when the weather wasn't exactly what you thought it was, or what was forecast.
Well, and you've pretty much flown as part of Air Transport Command to every continent in the world.
Except Antarctic.
Wow, it's absolutely amazing. Yeah, what was it like, you know, leaving your base in Trenton to fly into the Vietnam conflict?
That's a whole story in itself. The direct flight from Trenton to Vietnam, and our particular destination was Tan Son Nhut, which is the airport outside or close to Saigon. The direct route takes you literally over the pole, down through Russia and Cambodia and so on. And there's no way Russia would allow us to overfly, nor Cambodia. So we took the route of going from Trenton to Edmonton to Vancouver to a base that they called Shemya. It's the most westerly part of the Aleutians. From Shemya, we flew to, I think it was Yokosuka in Japan. And that leg, we crossed the international date line, and going from east to west, crossing the international date line, you lose a day.
Do you gain more fuel?
No, regrettably not. And then after Yokosuka, we landed in Tan Son Nhut. Now, there was a serious incident that occurred. This is all involved at the end of the Vietnam War. The Paris Peace Accords, which they'd been working on, and I'll describe who they are in a moment. The Paris Peace Accords were signed on Saturday morning, I think it was January 27th, 1977. And we were due to land on the 29th in Tan Son Nhut. Our mission was part of the Paris Peace Accords. And the orders and the accords provided for us to be on the ground no more than 4 hours, provided us to be allowed to refuel. It allowed for us to drop one person who happened to be an Army major Jimmy, and anyone with an Army background knows that a Jimmy is somebody from the Signals Corps, and about 200 pounds of top secret communications equipment. And we were allowed to be on the ground for 4 hours. So that was our restrictions. And from Tatsenut, we were to receive the orders of where to go. I believe it was Hong Kong. Well, there were four nations involved in the Paris Peace Accords from the perspective of implementing the peace, implementing those accords. Canada was one of the four. There were, in fact, two communist countries and two Western world countries. But the problem is, when you have people sitting around a table trying to come to an agreement to implement peace, everybody's got to have their heart and soul in what they have committed themselves to. Now, the Viet Cong had no reason to really want peace. They wanted complete control of all of that territory, what used to be known as French Indochina. And they certainly, the Viet Cong was certainly not happy with Canada being one of the four teams to implement the peace, because we were too friendly with the Americans. And the Viet Cong had decided, in effect, to give Canada a punch in the nose, and they were going to do that by blowing up our HERC. Now, the disadvantage of sitting around the table and working out all these sort of details is the enemy knows all your secrets. Because every little detail, like we've got 10,000 rounds of ammunition in this location and it has to be destroyed or shipped out, and it's agreed that you can blow up 5,000, and 5,000 shells have to be put on trucks and sent away on board ships. So they know all the secrets. They knew exactly where and when we were going to land at Tatsenut. So shortly after the landing time, a couple of Viet Cong popped out of the ground. And by the way, if you're not aware of it, Vietnam is just laced with tunnels. The Viet Cong had taken advantage of that. They had little factories underground. They had barracks and operation centers and little schools and things. But they popped out of the ground, saw the camouflaged HERC, ran up to it and threw a bandolier of dynamite around the cockpit and set the charge, and boom, blew the cockpit off the airplane. The problem was they got the wrong day. They forgot we came in the next day because of the international dateline. So some other nation lost a HERC, we didn't, but Mr. Trudeau and the cabinet quickly came to the conclusion that the target for that particular raid was our HERC, the Canadian HERC, and not this other fellow that got blown up. So they ordered us not to leave Vietnam. And once we went over that four-hour mark, our crew and our airplane were in violation of the Paris Peace Accords. So that's an international crime. But orders are orders. And then the situation deteriorated. One of the other four nations, Hungary, a communist country, started counting heads. Because if any of these nations had more than the 200 troops that were to be there, that's a violation. The cabinet decided Mort and our 15-man crew should not go around in uniform, and they ordered us out of uniform and to wear civvies. So here we are in a war zone in civvies. And some of you would know that as a military person, if you're captured in civvies, you can be shot immediately as a spy. So we were certainly put in harm's way. And their little skirmishes and attacks against the base at Tatsenut continued. And, of course, You know, this gets to be a long story, so I'll just tell you one more fact about it. The fact that we were ordered not to leave gave us an additional problem. Where do we stay? There was no provision within the Paris Peace Accords for us to stay on that military base. So when we asked for quarters, they said, well, if you're Canadians, you can't stay here. And we wouldn't leave the base because we'd never get back on. So that gave us an additional significant problem.
No food, no water, no accommodation, people with guns shooting at you, trying to blow up your airplane. And as you said, the Viet Cong didn't want you there. The Hungarians didn't want you there. The Americans weren't happy.
Well, the Americans were in full retreat. Full retreat. It was a sight to behold. They were blowing up everything in sight. Everything that they couldn't put on their ships or their transport aircraft, they were destroying.
And if I recall from your one of your earlier presentations, you were under the direction of the cabinet, not the Department of National Defense.
That's right.
So non-military people giving you orders.
Yeah.
In a conflict zone with no practical experience, that doesn't necessarily sound like a winning strategy.
Talk about barrack room lawyers.
Yeah, very bad. Yeah. But on the positive note, since you're here today, February of 2024, obviously the HERC and the Canadian air crew exited Vietnam without a lot of bullet holes in the HERC.
Strange things happen, you know. Some years later, in 2014, I got a letter from the father of one of the officers at Tan Son Nhut. The officer at Tan Son Nhut helped us survive. And surprisingly, the son had joined the United States Air Force, got up to the rank of Major General, and had retired. It's amazing how the years go by.
It's a very, very small world, isn't it?
Yeah, sure is.
Well, Uncle Mort, thank you so much for being part of Plane Talk. No doubt, more to come.
It's been a pleasure to be here with you, Phil, and I hope your audience can appreciate the experiences that I described.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Plane Talk. If you have any ideas for a future Plane Talk episode, please go to the Contact Us page at plaintalk.ca and send in your idea. Don't forget to like us at plaintalk.ca, our Facebook and LinkedIn pages, and this podcast. And never stop living the dream.